Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Jodi Picco. Wellington Square Bookshop is really thrilled to host Jodi at the Hilton Garden Inn in Exton on Tuesday, October 25th at 2 p.m. Jodi's going to be on hand to read from her latest novel, which we'll be talking about today, Small Great Things. And following the reading, she'll discuss the book and answer readers' questions. So you know, and this is all housekeeping, tickets can be purchased on eventbrite.com, that's B-R-I-T-E, by entering Wellington Square Bookshop in the Browse Events tab. The cost of the ticket is $33.99, which includes a signed copy of the book, a $5 gift certificate to the store, coffee and dessert at the Hilton, and a donation made to Vita, Women in Literary Arts, in Jodi's honor.
Jodi's that's so nice.
No problem. I was happy to do it. We are happy to do it. Jodi's an advisory board member of Vita, whose goal is to increase critical attention to contemporary women's writing and to foster transparency around gender and racial equality, which we'll talk about today, issues that are, you know, omnipresent in contemporary literary culture. And then following the events, attendees are invited back to the bookshop. Hopefully, should time allow, Jodi can come back too. Shuttles will run the short distance between the hotel and bookshop. When I say short, I mean 2 minutes. And if you want to drive back, you can do that as well. So seating is rapidly approaching capacity. So if we had a bigger venue, I know we could have filled that too. I wish we did. So those wishing to attend are encouraged to purchase tickets soon, as the event will sell out well in advance. But back to the work at hand. Jodi's the best-selling author of 23, maybe I guess now 24 novels, everything from her debut Songs of the Humpback Whale to Salem Falls, My Sister's Keeper, Leaving Time, and now her latest work, Small Great Things, just published last week by Ballantine. Small Great Things is the story of Ruth, an African-American labor and delivery nurse, her son Edison, her friends, her attorney Kennedy, and on the other side, Turk and his wife, Britt. And I guess, in a way, most importantly, their son, Davis, about whom the entire novel pivots. But the novel also pivots around a situation in modern America, the concept of racial parity, of racial equality, or better still, as Jodi and Kennedy say in the book, racial equity. Are we as white American men and women able to be truly colorblind, or should we? Can we ever experience what it's like to be labeled second fiddle, second best, second class? Kennedy puts it well in the book when she asks the jury, how would you like it if you were born on a Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, got treated really well in life, got the best tickets, the best seats, early dismissal, but if you were born on a Friday or Saturday, you rode in the back of the bus, got the second class jobs, and were denied the best education? In summary, the novel deals gracefully with a topic which has reared its ugly head in this election cycle, and all around our country, from police shootings to football games and the national anthem. So the novel couldn't have arrived at a more propitious time. So, Jodi, thanks for joining us, and thanks even more for coming to see us next week.
Of course.
You know, maybe to begin, in the first presidential debate, Hillary Clinton said what I thought was a very dangerous thing. In it, she implied, if not expressed, the fact that we all have bias.
Oh, my God, it was the best moment!
I know, but isn't it scary to say that, like, for real?
No, it is critical to say that, and it is huge that a white candidate for president said that. We do all have implicit bias. If you don't believe me, there's actually just Google implicit bias, and there's this fantastic test that comes up that Harvard put out that will show you how even if you think you have no bias, you have bias. It's not your fault. It's the way you grow up in society, but it's part of the reason for this book. You know, there is. There's part of the equation of racism is not just prejudice. We could take every white supremacist and ship them off to Mars, and there would still be racism in the United States. That's because racism is prejudice plus power. And if you happen to be born white, you have the power in this country. So even if you are not considering yourself an active racist, even if you are not a white supremacist, you are still part of that equation. And that's what I'm trying really hard to get white people to wake up to in this book.
But then the corollary of that, and kind of playing devil's advocate, is you take the protagonist, Ruth, who's a wonderful woman, kind of like an angel. Not like an angel, but she's a wonderful woman. But does she also have an undercurrent of corollary bias herself?
She does, but by definition, the group that is oppressed cannot be racist.
I agree.
Mean, you know, go talk to anyone who is a racial justice educator, and they will tell you that. So, you know, you hear about, quote, reverse racism. That does not exist. That's actually not a thing, ever. You know, and it's interesting. One of the things that you said leading into this is the idea that this could not come at a more propitious time, that we keep hearing about these things on the news, that we hear about those unarmed African-American men who are being shot by police. Well, I would argue, actually, that this has been going on for 200 years in America. The reason it feels so timely is not because the incidences of racism, overt racism, have increased. It's that we are hearing about them because of social media, because of 24/7 news cycles. For those reasons, the world has become a little smaller and a little more accessible. We are just now, however, hearing about something that has been going on for a very long time.
Yeah, look, if there wasn't video cameras or body cams, we wouldn't be talking about this. It's funny because I was reading your book as I was going through the Charlotte airport, and I was thinking, well, maybe she's overdoing it. Maybe she's portraying this as if it was the 50s and not the 2000s.
Wait.
Let me finish. So I'm walking to the Charlotte airport. I get my shoes shined. The only guy's shining shoes are black. I'm walking through the airport. The restroom is being cleaned. Who's cleaning the restroom? And I kept looking, and every job I saw that I would not want to have was taken by an African-American or a Latino person.
Mm-hmm.
And
here's a really good example. I actually am stealing this from something I actually saw on Facebook that someone called my attention to. If you as a white person really think things aren't so bad in this country for people of color, I want you to ask yourself very honestly, would you want to be treated the way America treats people of color?
Yeah.
Just ask yourself that question. And I think you're going to find it really hard to say yes.
Yeah, I think Chris Rock talks about that, too. He talks about, yeah, I got all this money and all this stuff, but if you could give me a chance to be white, I'd take that in a minute.
Yeah, it's the winning lottery card.
Yeah. It's funny, too, because, you know, you have the reverse panoply of characters like Turk and Brit and all their gang, if you want to call it. And Turk doesn't really have, until a certain point in the book, redeeming qualities, but at the very beginning, when he recognizes how his brother's death occurred, there's a moment, there's a moment where he could have pivoted right there, and that he chooses not to.
Mm-hmm. And part of it is, you know, the cycle he's been brought up in.
Yeah. Well, what do you, you know, I haven't asked you to tell us about the book, and that always sounds quick. Sorry, why don't you tell us about the book?
Sure. So I'll tell you about the genesis of the book, because that helps me describe it. I actually wanted to write about racism 20 years ago. Something happened in New York that really upset me. I was living there at the time, and there was an African-American undercover cop who was shot 4 times in the back in the subway by white colleagues, even though he was wearing this wristband that identified him with the color of the day, meaning he was undercover. And I started to write this book, and I failed. I just could not do it. I could not write the voice of someone of color. And, you know, I basically was second-guessing myself and saying, well, this isn't really my story to write, is it? I mean, I'm not a person of color. I don't know what it's like to really live as a person of color in America. And plus, there are plenty of great African-American authors who are doing a really good job of that without my interference. But then I kept revisiting it over the years, and I would think, well, okay, wait a second. I write as people that I'm not all the time. I mean, I write as men. I write as rape victims. I write as Holocaust survivors. I write as school shooters. Again, I've never been any of those people either, so why is this different? Well, it's because race is different and racism is different. It's really hard to talk about without offending someone, and so as a result, we often just don't talk about it at all. So fast forward to 2012, and I come across yet another news story. This one, it comes from Flint, Michigan, and it involves an African-American nurse with 20 years of experience on a labor and delivery ward who helps deliver a baby, and then the father calls in her supervisor, and he says, I don't want her or anyone who looks like her to touch my infant, and he pulls up his sleeve to reveal a swastika tattoo. Let me remind you, this was 5 years ago. And in their infinite wisdom, quote unquote, the hospital put a post-it note on the baby's file saying no African-American personnel to touch this infant. The nurse sued. She settled and got, I hope, a tremendous payout. But it made me wonder, what if she'd been the only one there when something went wrong with that baby? What if she had to decide between following her supervisor's orders or saving that baby's life? What if, as a result, she wound up on trial with a white public defender who, like me, like many people I know, would never consider herself to be a racist? What if I could tell the story from the point of view of that African-American nurse, the white public defender, and the white supremacist dad, as they all revisited their beliefs about power and privilege and race? And suddenly I knew I'd nailed it. I could write this book. And it was because I had shifted the audience and I had shifted the intent. I wasn't writing to try to tell people of color what their lives are like. I don't have the right to do that, and I never will. I was writing to white people to say, hey, open your eyes. It's really easy to point to a white supremacist and say, that person's a racist. It's a lot harder to point to yourself and say the same thing. But because racism isn't just about bias, because it's also about power, you are part of the problem of racism, even if you're a good person, just because you're white. And although it's really easy for us to see the headwinds of racism, the ways that it's harder as a person of color in America to achieve success, it's harder for us to sort of wrap our heads around those tailwinds of racism, the things that white people get as advantages that make it easier for them to achieve success. You know, so maybe, for example, you have your apartment because your landlord didn't want to rent to someone black, and you don't even know that. Or maybe you went to a great school because you did well on your SATs, and that's because your mom was there to read to you every night when you were a kid, where a person of color had a mom not reading to them because she was working three jobs to make ends meet. When you begin to unravel your history like that, all of a sudden you begin to see that the opportunities you had are a direct result of the fact that someone of color may not have had those opportunities. And suddenly the American dream isn't quite so dreamy.
Yeah, and unfortunately, notwithstanding your attempts to make people think differently, the world today doesn't seem to care, especially...
Well, you know, I think it's not as dire as that. What I think is that I'd like to believe that America is not full of white supremacists. I would like to believe that most people are good people, and most people are deeply upset about some of the things that they see on the news, the overt examples of the ways that black lives do not matter as much as white lives. But they don't know how to talk about it. They don't have the vocabulary. They're afraid of saying something wrong. And I would like to hope that this book gives them a springboard so that they can jump into that discussion. Start by talking about these characters. Talk about Ruth and Kennedy and Turk, and then segue into the real world.
Well, if you want to do that, then here's why you're good. You trick the reader in a way, because you take a couple like Mr. and Mrs. Hollowell, the voice of NBC, and Miss Mina, and you have Ruth's mom working there. And they help out a lot. I mean, they really do help out a lot. Mm-hmm. And they make Ruth's life completely different than it would have been otherwise.
Correct.
And so then as a reader, you're going, well, wait a minute. These people really helped out a lot. And they helped out a lot because they just really wanted to help. And then you take their daughter, Christina, who's a very interesting character.
Mm-hmm.
And she's torn inside and eventually makes a certain decision with regard to her feelings. But as a reader, that's when you got to stop and you keep the book open with your thumb in between the pages, and you start thinking, well, I don't really know. Are they doing this because somehow it makes them feel like better people?
Mm-hmm.
Or are, well, you're saying, like that's why they did it.
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of ways that I think white people try to enter the conversation, some of which are, as racial justice educators will tell you, healthy ways, and some of which are not. And yes, absolutely, the Hollowells make life different for Ruth. Is it better? That's a good question. You know, you could argue that as a result of what they've done and the opportunities that they afford Ruth by giving her access to a a very prestigious private school, for example, you know, which again helps catapult her into a very good college and a nursing school at Yale. You know, the question becomes, is that good? Because she has trouble relating to people who look like her as a result. She really doesn't fit into either world. And then there's the whole idea of the white savior. Some people think that the way to combat racism is to go in and tell a community of color, I can help you. Well, here's a newsflash. They don't need your help. There are terrific leaders of color who are doing a great job all by themselves. But here's something you can do. When you're a white person, you always get the microphone. People always want to listen to your opinions, and you always have a seat at the metaphorical table. So you can use that privilege. You can leverage that privilege by stepping up to the microphone, tapping it and going, hello, hello, is everyone listening? And then passing it to someone whose voice is not quite as amplified, hopefully a person of color.
That makes perfect sense. I never even thought of it.
But,
you know, if still playing devil's advocate, it's like you can't because you wrote them. But I can't look into my own unconscious. I can't look into my motives. Only up to a certain point I can, but there comes a point where you can't. I was just thinking about this last night. I'm walking my cats, going, what do I really stand for? What is it that I stand for? I'm trying to examine it, and I couldn't get to the bottom of it. And you're asking me to make a decision, but I can't. I can't say whether I am biased or not. For example, I adopted, my ex-wife and I adopted two Chinese children. Mm-hmm. And I never have ever looked at them as being Chinese. So when someone says, you know, ask me, is their mother Chinese or were they adopted? I don't know what they're talking about. I have no idea. Because mm-hmm. when I look at them, I just see Samantha
you
and Annie.
You see your kids.
Yeah,
sure.
I just see my kids. And I've always been that way. And that actually did what you suggest I do. It gave me the opportunity to see other people see this differently than I do.
Exactly.
And,
right. And, you know, probably, I obviously don't know your situation. I think it's awesome and cool. And I assume that your children came from China?
Yes.
So, I mean, at some point, you might take it upon yourself to learn what culture would be like for them had they grown up in China.
I know exactly what it would be like because Annie had a cleft palate and Samantha wasn't.
Right, okay.
I know exactly what happened.
Yeah. So, yes, you definitely gave them opportunities that they probably would not have had they been growing up in an orphanage somewhere in China. And that's fantastic. And more importantly, you love your kids. I mean, that's the absolute bottom line. You're not seeing them as Chinese. You're seeing them as your children.
But I've always felt to myself, I can't. I'm lazy. And it's like, it's too hard work to help anybody. To help everybody. So all I've ever been able to do in my life is help one person at a time. That's
all. Like, here's a really good way to think about it. What do you know about Chinese history?
Not a great deal.
So why? Like, maybe that's, I don't know how old your kids are, but maybe one day when they start to realize I don't have the same facial features that my dad does, you know, they might want to know more. Where did I come from? What was it like there? And that's something that you can learn about, you can educate yourself about.
And I have.
In other words, it's not just the white perspective that they might want to know. It's okay for you to learn a different perspective as well. I talk about this a lot, you know, in terms of African-American culture. Who do we know about in our schools? What do we learn? Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King Jr. Have you ever heard of Lewis Latimer?
Nope.
Okay, why not? Go look him up. That's your homework today.
Okay, I'm ready.
Go look him up and ask yourself, why isn't this in the curriculum in high schools? Who's Henry Ossian Flipper? Go look him up.
I remember Edison talking about
them. There's a whole world of African-American history that we do not learn about in schools beyond the Civil War and slavery and then the Civil Rights Movement.
But that's true of, like, the Western canon and, you know, reading Moby Dick and reading Shakespeare and reading whether it's War and Peace. We limit mm-hmm. ourselves in so many different ways that way.
Right. But that's the word. You limit yourself.
Yes.
You know, history and curriculum, for that matter, is always written by the winners. But that doesn't, you know, when you think about Black history and what we're taught, we tend to be taught about an African-American person is a victim, when there are so many examples of strength and power and leadership in all fields in African-American culture that we don't always learn about.
Well, look, you paint these characters. I can't make that, emphasize that too much. So if you take Ruth's sister.
Yeah, Adisa.
Yeah.
She's prickly, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really.
You
and bet. I got mad at her. I'm like arguing, no, I don't do that. And why do you assume mm-hmm. that everybody's going to be like that? You mm-hmm. you made her. And what am I supposed to do with her? You tell me what I'm supposed to do with her.
Well, what you're supposed to do with her is just stand there and listen. And let me tell you why. Because for 200 years, a lot of African American people have not had a voice. And now, very quietly and very slightly, we are hearing those voices, thanks in large part to the Black Lives Matter movement, which is great. You know, and here's the thing, when you've been silenced for 200 years, do you think that you're going to come out going, excuse me, can I just have a little something to say? No, you're going to come out explosive and go, thank God, it's about time. And yes, that's going to sound like anger to our ears. That's absolutely legitimate. You know, when you don't have a voice for a very long time, you scream to be heard. And to us, it may sound angry and restrictive and full of assumptions. And right now, it is kind of our role, because of the oppression that we've sort of laid on this community for 200 years, it's our job to sit there and just say, yes, let me have it. I totally get why you feel that way. Don't say anything. Do not criticize. Just for the first time maybe in your life, just listen. And understand that the person who's talking to you is coming from a very deep place of hurt.
Look, I practiced law for 30 years. There's
cool.
No way I would have let Ruth get on the stand. No
That's
way.
That's right. Oh, my God, did I have big fights with the lawyers I was working with. And I was like, look, I don't care what you say. She's getting on the stand. And you're right. And that's a huge problem.
Well, she got on the stand, and you made it very clear. She got on the stand because of anger, and mm-hmm. the anger trumped whether or not she was going to prevail or not.
Just... She got on the stand because winning the case is not as important for
right.
her as the principal.
Right.
And let's face it, if you were a lawyer for 30 years, you know you don't bring up race in court because that's how you're going to lose.
Correct.
And there's very clear examples of that in the book, where you can even see in picking a jury how assumptions are made about people based on what they say, and how people who think they're not biased may wind up with a great deal of bias and might, you know, completely ruin your jury pool if you're the defense attorney. You know, it's much safer to not mention race, even in cases that are so unbelievably, unequivocally race-based. You know, like, for example, the George Zimmerman trial, when Trayvon Martin was shot, the judge actually physically banned the term racial profiling from being uttered in court.
It's Florida.
Yeah. That's ridiculous.
It was horrible. It was horrible. Absolutely horrible.
Right.
Well, what about, okay, well then let's switch to the prosecution. What about Odette? What kind of person is Odette? Well, I'm doing this like everybody's read this book. They haven't had time to. So I always do this. I'm sorry. Talk a little bit about Odette and what kind of person she was as the prosecutor, especially with regard
Odette
to...
Odette is the prosecutor. She is an African-American woman. She has worked really, really hard to get where she is. And in many ways, she is a mirror image of Ruth. Ruth, like Odette, has succeeded, in spite of all the odds against her, to achieve a measure of success in her profession, and has done it in a white world as an African-American woman. And part of her success as a prosecutor involves, in this case, criticizing a woman of color very much like her. You know, and Ruth holds her accountable for that. It's kind of like, you know, how? Come on, we're in this together. Why are you against me? You know, she has to walk a very unbalanced line to keep her position. That's kind of where Odette is at. And in a way, what Ruth learns and the slow simmering anger that boils in Ruth over the course of this book is something Odette has not tapped into yet because she's still trying to survive in the white world.
It was really a nice thing, though, she did for Edison, I thought.
Right. I mean, but that's it. So she's, you know, she's basically, she's doing what she can, knowing that there are constraints on her.
It's funny that, really quickly, Judge Thunder, whose name is great,
yeah.
You must have thought about that for a while.
Well, I had a good time, yeah.
But he's a really good judge. He's the kind of judge that used to be the judge when I started practicing law. Like, mm-hmm. if you didn't do your interrogatories, he would say, okay, well, you can just spend the next 5 months and 29 days in jail then for contempt. Whereas
right.
now it's go, well, I'll give you a couple more weeks. I liked it the old way. But it's
yeah.
funny because I had this judge, Judge Yawn. And he was exactly the opposite.
That's
of Judge.
So funny.
And he would put you to sleep. So when I read Judge Thunder, I thought of Judge Yawn.
That's great.
Talk about the incident. This is a pivotal incident, too, because at first when I read it, I thought, no, she's exaggerating. This doesn't happen. She's overdoing it. And then I thought, well, maybe not. And it's the incident at TJ Maxx with Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
With Kennedy.
Yeah. So in TJ Maxx, we see Ruth is shopping with Kennedy for a gift for Ruth's mom. And she's basically being trailed by a white store manager who is expecting her to shoplift. And then after she leaves the store, you know, she's paid for what she's looking for, and she is stopped by a security guard. They ask to see the receipt, even though Kennedy is not asked to show her receipt because, you know, she's white. And this is absolutely not a lie. You know, I as I said, I did a lot of research with women of color when I was writing this book, and every single one of them had a story like this. Every single one of them.
The best part of that whole scene was the fact that Kennedy opens the bag of popcorn and starts eating it.
And, right, and that was really, really funny because one of the women who was a sensitivity reader for me and who vetted the voice of Ruth, she, an African-American woman, she was like, she said she got a visceral reaction to that scene. And she was like, oh, my God, what is she doing? Why is she opening that? Like, she could not, she actually said it made her realize how careful she is, you know, when she shops. Now, look, I remember taking my kids to the grocery store when they were tiny, and you go to the deli counter, and, you know, they give you a slice of cheese or a turkey or something for your kid to eat, or you open up a bag of chips and you give it to them, or whatever it is that, you know, animal crackers, and then you pay for it when you get to the line. And I would never even think twice about that. Of course I'm going to pay for it. But that assumption is not the default if you are a person of color very often. So I wanted to illustrate that. I wanted to have a scene that sort of put you in the shoes of Ruth for a second. And in a way, you know, the reason for that is because Ruth is actually trying to show this very clearly to Kennedy.
Well, it's funny because I remember this routine by Dave Chappelle where he's talking about driving around at night with this white guy and they're drinking and smoking and they get lost. And the white guy goes, I'll just stop this police officer and ask him for directions. And Dave Chappelle's like cringing and rolling down into the seat onto the floor.
Right.
Because again, the chances are you're going to go to jail or be shot.
Right. Well, so I'm going to tell you a story about someone who is actually not even a person of color. My son, Kyle, was stopped for speeding. He was driving the car, and his partner, Kevin, who is Portuguese, so technically white, but looks Latino, was sitting in the passenger seat. And the officer, he was in Connecticut, and the officer asked for Kyle's license and registration. He gave it to them. And then he asked for Kevin's license. Now, Kevin does not drive, and so he handed over his passport. And Kyle was sitting there going, why does he want Kevin's license? Kevin's in the passenger seat. He's done absolutely nothing wrong. He's not even driving. But he didn't speak up because he was afraid that would escalate.
Correct.
And Kyle was a white man who didn't speak up.
Well, that's
the
problem.
You know, so imagine being a person of color in those circumstances. I mean, there's not a single man of color who I have talked to who was not taught by their mother, if the police pull you over, you put your hands right on the dashboard where everyone can see them.
But I've told my son all his life, I say, never, ever argue with someone who has plenary power over you, whether it's a custom agent, police officer, whatever. And he does. He argues all the time. But if he were black, he would not have gotten this far in his life.
No. And, you know, that bottom line for all of these shootings that we've seen that are so awful, you know, think about, for example, the shootings of young men who maybe shoplifted and ran from a store. You know, I've engaged in dialogue with people who say to me, well, you know, those were bad kids. Well, I got to tell you, if my white sons had shoplifted, yes, they would have been doing something wrong, but I can promise you they would not have been shot. They would have been handcuffed. They would have been, you know, brought into a police station. They would have gone for an arraignment. They might have been put in jail for a little while, but they wouldn't be dead.
Well, actually, in the suburbs of Philadelphia or in Chevy Chase, Maryland, they probably would have been taken into the office and given a scolding and sent on their way.
Right, that's true. A lot depends on the color of your skin.
Yeah. Well, you know, that goes to, you got like six, I call them epigraphs, even though they're at the head of the chapters, but the title itself is a part of the epigraph because it's Martin Luther King. If I cannot do great things, I can do small things in a great way. So what are you telling me? You sound like you're almost militant in what you're saying today.
I am a little, yeah.
What Martin Luther King, not enough, that you can, you know, think globally, act locally, that kind of thing.
Because racism is systemic and institutional. You could ship every white supremacist off to Mars and you would still have racism, as I said. But it is both perpetuated and dismantled in individual acts. No one person is going to get rid of racism. But thinking twice about your actions, about your biases, making sure that you are aware of and are leveraging your privilege, those are ways to move the needle forward.
Well, then you honestly believe that people are good people, because if they're not good people, they're not going to do that.
I do believe people are good.
So do I. But,
yeah.
But, hey, how come you made Ruth so light-skinned?
Because there's also, you know, I could have written a book that was 7,000 pages. There was so much to put into this. But there is definitely a bias within black culture about skin color. And people with light skin are often, light black skin are often given advantages that people with dark black skin are not. And I wanted to just graze the surface of some of that bias that Ruth would experience at the hands of people who look like her.
Yeah, it's funny. I like that little talk when they were looking for this DVD and they talked about the Cosby Show.
Right.
And that was pretty funny, too.
Yeah.
Hey, how come you always, and not that I'm going to spoil this, but how come there's always, why do you choose to put twists in your novels? What is it about them that you love so much?
It's not that I love them. It's that sometimes I think they're a great way to tell the story. And I like to keep people guessing. You know, it's not that I feel every book should have a twist, but if it's the right way for the story to go, then that's the way I'm gonna shoot it.
Well, I won't go any further into that because then I will spoil it, so I'm not going to do
Don't.
That. I won't. No. That must be something you worry about all the time. Sometimes reviews, though, they give it away, and it's horrible if you must read them and see where they've come.
Yeah, I don't like that.
No.
I get really angry.
Well, so if you talk about, say, James Baldwin's quote, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. I guess what you're saying is, mm-hmm. especially at the beginning of that chapter, that you don't think that white Americans have faced this.
No, I don't. I think, and again, some of it, I think, is unintentional.
Yeah.
You know, people who think, here's a great way to think about it. Here's racism. Racism is the moving walkway at the airport. You know how if you stand on a moving walkway, you're still going to get to the other side, but if you walk on it, you're going to get there faster?
Yep.
Okay, so if you are a skinhead, you are walking on the moving walkway in a certain direction. If you are an average white person in America who doesn't consider themselves to be racist and who doesn't think they're part of the problem, you are standing still on that escalator. You're still going to get to the same point. It's just going to be a little later than the skinhead. if you are really actively anti-racist, if you want to make a difference, if you want to check your privilege, if you want to admit to the fact that the life you have had, the upbringing you have had, is different than the life a person of color has had, you need to turn around on that walkway and you need to move twice as fast.
I don't know. It's a big challenge. Jeez. I mean, you're asking a lot of me, and me, by me, I mean everyone.
You know, am I?
Yeah,
am I, really?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I'm not proud enough to say that, oh, yeah, I understand exactly what you say, and that's what I'm going to be like, because I catch myself all the time doing the things that you're talking about.
Right.
I can't help
so
it.
Catch yourself and stop doing it. I mean, my God, I've never met you. I'm assuming you're a white male.
Yes.
So you have had every privilege afforded to anyone in society. You are the top of the chain.
Correct.
And if you're at the top of the chain, isn't it your responsibility to acknowledge that there are things about you and there are privileges you've had that have gotten you to that pinnacle? And if you're standing on the top, should you just stand there and look around, or should you reach down and help somebody else?
Well, I'd like to think that I have. But my problem is, as I stated before, I can only do it one at a time. It's really hard for me to.
Yeah.
You're asking.
But that's okay. What I'm saying is, you do not have to go out and become a racial justice educator. You do not have to be shouting this from the rooftops. You don't even have to write a novel like I did about racism. You have to find a way that you yourself can be an ally. That's all. And it might be different than the way I do it. For you, it might be as simple as going to Thanksgiving dinner, and when you hear your uncle tell a racist joke, instead of just going, oh, it's uncle, you know, so-and-so, say, hey, you know what? Let me tell you why you really shouldn't say that.
Well, you know, I kind of have been through it, because being Jewish, when I moved, when I practiced law in Gainesville, Florida, of all places, they didn't know I was Jewish when they hired me. When they realized that they had hired me, they didn't want to have me there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time, because I grew up in just outside of Philadelphia, not knowing there were people that weren't Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the first time I experienced anti-Semitism, and it did give me a feeling of what it must be like. Because
right. And, you know, it's funny, because I think that is a way in for a lot of people. You know, if you've been the minority in a certain situation, yes, you do get a taste of it. It's still a little different. You know, one of the things when people say, we talked a little bit about, you know, how maybe saying I'm colorblind is not right. Well, saying, hey, I'm a minority too, again, that sort of takes away from the narrative of people of color. Yes, right now, you know, there are moments that you might feel targeted as a Jewish person, but at this moment in history, you know, you don't have to worry about being shot by police if you're Jewish.
Right. And also, Turk gives a good hierarchy of his hate, remember?
Yes. Right.
I'm in there.
You're in there.
I'm way up.
I promise you, all those white supremacists, they're still worried about you.
Yeah, I know. I'm way up there. I'm not at the top, but I'm way up there. I beat some people. So when you drew Turk and Brit, who I think, in my viewpoint, is much worse than Turk, and I guess probably you feel the same way.
Yeah, it was actually very hard to write them.
Yes.
Often after writing Turk, I had to take a shower. I just felt gross.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very strange, because just like you were talking about the moving stairway, I don't consider I don't know those people exist. You're teaching me. I mean, you're telling me.
Oh, they're
that.
Out there.
I know, because look at this election. I mean,
yeah.
It's framed in that fashion, but it's really hard to, on a day-to-day basis, factor them in. And you know, you're right too. I have friends who make pejorative remarks, and I tend not to say anything. And you're right; that would be one small courageous act.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's like what you're saying when you quoted Ray Bradbury, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you know, here's the thing: is you're acting, as I said, militant, and you're acting as if a lot can be achieved in a very short time. Whereas in the Ray Bradbury epigraph, if you will, it's someone who wants to get at hate a little bit at a time, at finding a chink in the armor and taking out one pebble and then another until the wall finally falls. Don't you think that's the way it has to happen? It can't happen all at once. Nelson Mandela has to stay in jail for 20 years.
Right. Yeah, it's like I said, it won't happen all at once. It will not happen with one person. But it will also not happen if white people don't understand that they need to talk about this too. This isn't a black problem. This isn't a black issue. Racism is an issue for everyone in this country.
Well, I can't wait till you come to speak, because I think maybe we should like arm wrestle or something.
I'm going to win.
Everything I've read, all your interviews, is like, I'm scared to meet you in a dark alley, you know?
Well, thank you. I'll take that as a great big compliment.
Well, thanks so much for joining. I really enjoyed talking to you, and it was very enlightening too. And the book is great, and it's on our, it's on our front table. It'll stay on our front table, and we'll have a great time when you come to see us.
Oh, terrific. I can't wait. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was Jodi Picou talking to us about her new book, Small Great Things, which is a story about Ruth, a labor and delivery nurse who is accused of murder, and the trial that subsequently occurs, and the variety of characters that you meet along the way who, in one way or the other, kind of act as gnomons of the conversation that I had today with Jodi. It's a trip that you take through here, and as I said, you know, there's always a twist in her books, and it's a lot of times about a trial, but it's a very interesting journey. And as you could tell from my responses today, some of the things that are brought up were things that I've never thought of or never thought I needed to think about, but in actuality, I kind of was enlightened a little bit today. So that'll be a lot of fun. Remember what I said, tickets are going very, very rapidly. She'll be here on the 25th at the Hilton Garden Inn, and it's at 2 o'clock. She's going to read from Small Great Things, which will be great, and then afterwards she'll answer questions and discuss the book. The tickets are at Eventbrite, B-R-I-T-E, Eventbrite, one word. You enter Wellington Square Bookshop, in the Browse Events tab. You pay $33.99, which includes a signed copy of the book, which is almost the price right there, a $5 gift certificate to the bookstore, which is more than the price, coffee and dessert, which is extra and I'm paying for, and a donation made to Jodi's charitable organization, VITA, Women in Literary Arts. So it should be a great time, but tickets are going rapidly. We'll be up to 175, which is our limit. I could have gotten a different venue and gotten 400 people, but this is the best I could do. So I look forward to you coming by and meeting me. Not that it's necessary that you meet me, but definitely meeting Jodi. So keep joining us. We're thanks to the help from Kathy at Chester County Books, and thanks to the fact that a lot of you who were patrons of that store have now come to our store. I think we'll get more and more authors to sign at our store. You know, we've gotten Christina Baker Klein, we've gotten Jodi, we're getting Liz Moore. It looks like it's going to be a very good year, and it looks like it's going to be a very good coming year with regard to books that I get to talk to authors about and authors that I get to talk with at our store. Coming up, we have best-selling author Lynn Cox, who's an amazing, amazing person who's broken every open water swimming record there is, from swimming the English Channel at 15 and setting every record for men or women, to swimming in the Antarctic, to swimming the Bering Strait, trying to bring Russia and the United States together back in the 70s, and Gorbachev and Reagan praised her. I just can't say enough about her. But her latest book is called Swimming in the Sink, An Episode of the Heart. And then long-listed Man Booker Award author Madeline Thien will be here to discuss her nominated novel, Do Not Say We Have Nothing. And just in time for Thanksgiving, Elaine Kosova will discuss Butter, A Rich History. You know, there's that book Cod, there's that book Paper, there's that book Salt. Talk about these commodities that we take for granted. So this one's butter, and we'll find out everything you want to know and perhaps more about that condiment. So in any event, thanks as always for joining us here on The Avid Reader, and we look forward to talking with you and a world-renowned author next week.